This is Digital Story Podcast number 856, August 16th, 2022. Today's theme is Mastering Your Autofocus. I'm Derek Story. Like many other advanced features on our cameras, we often take autofocus for granted. These days, it works that well. But it's also quite customizable, and it's worth taking a few minutes to wander through the camera's AF menu to tailor its performance to our preferred way of shooting. We'll take a closer look at that on today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. As our cameras have improved, so has my trust in their AF systems. I'm telling you, it wasn't that long ago, honestly, that I relied almost solely on SAF, right? Single frame autofocus, for all of my work. I had been burned by missed focus shots in the past, and I couldn't afford for that to happen on the job. I mean, what if the one shot that is the perfect expression and the perfect, you know, configuration is the one shot where the autofocus decides to focus on a poster, right in between the two people? I know you've had that happen. Okay, so, but things have changed, and things have gotten better with our cameras, and especially if you have a new Canon, if you have a new Nikon, if you have a new Panasonic, new Fujifilm, new Sony, and yes, new OM-1, autofocus is really a wonderful thing, and it's probably worth revisiting, right, those settings to make sure we're taking advantage of this technology that's right there in our hands. So I thought, okay, let's just wander through the AF menu today and talk a little bit about the options that we have, the basic options. Now, specific cameras are going to have specific things and, you know, all that. But let's just do some broad brushstrokes here, because I have a feeling that some of you possibly haven't looked at your AF menu for a while. And we're going to change that today, alrighty? I think first I'll mosey through just the basic options that we have for autofocusing, and then we'll talk about some of the nuance as well. And let's start out with the classic single frame autofocus, SAF. Still the most reliable way to autofocus a camera, because really you're in control. You pick a point, a sensor point, a focusing point, and you position that point wherever you want. Often it's just in the center of the frame. You put that point on what you want in focus, and you press the shutter button halfway. The camera locks in on that part of the composition. You continue pressing the shutter, take the picture, and that part of the frame will be in focus. Every time, it'll be in focus. So single AF is still the most reliable way to take a picture. The challenge with it is that it isn't always suitable for certain situations, events, sports, things like that. It doesn't work quite as well, or it's not quite as practical, I should say. It still works well, but it's not as practical in those settings. So sometimes we want to use some of the other autofocusing tricks our camera has. But at the end of the day, if you really want to nail the focus, single point autofocus is a great way to go. Now, there's a variation on this technique called back button focus, and almost every camera does this. So essentially, you have the shutter button on top, right? And you're pressing that with your index finger. And then almost always, there's a AF button on the back of the camera, an autofocus button on the back of the camera. You can set up your camera so that the back button enables the focusing, allowing you to have the back button and the shutter button basically operate somewhat independently when it comes to focusing. And so now the shutter button is really locking the exposure and taking the picture, and the back button is handling the focusing duties. On the OM-1, for example, you go to menu, AF1, and then there's AF by half pressing button symbol, right? And on that, for SAF, you put no. So that's kind of a weird way to go about back button focusing, right? Because they're not really calling it out. Basically, what they're saying is that you half press the shutter button, no, which means then if you press the AF button on the back, then that's a yes. And the reason why I cite this particular one is that often to set up back button focusing for your particular camera, it requires a trip to Google, right? You have to do a little Google research to find out exactly, because every camera seems like they set it up differently. Now, some folks absolutely love back button focusing. I'm okay with it. Sometimes I use it, but I'm still all right with the half press shutter. But a lot of folks really do like that back button trick. If you're one of them, take a trip to Google, find out how to set it up for your camera, and play with it. That may be one of those little things that kind of gets you excited about using your camera all over again. So that's all under the header, Single Frame Autofocus SAF. Now, next we have Continuous Autofocus CAF. This is something that I really have only warmed up to in the last few years, all right? Now, every camera, again, is a bit different in its implementation. But generally speaking, once you go into continuous autofocus mode, you half press the shutter and it looks for something to focus on, finds it, and then will continuously focus on that. Yeah, even as it kind of moves left, right, forward, back, all that kind of stuff. It is continuously focusing the camera. I had problems with it back in the days because I felt like I was getting a lot of missed focus shots with it. However, these days, and especially since I started shooting with the OM-1, I use continuous autofocus with burst mode for a lot of my event shooting. So my setup for this will be the 40 to 150, generally speaking, and continuous autofocusing and then burst mode. And I don't go super high burst mode because I don't want to come home with 5,000 frames. So I usually keep my burst mode to something like 4 or 5 frames per second. That seems to do the job for, you know, event work. And I have found that my number of hits with this camera in particular have been great. And it just really does give me a lot of different choices for that perfect frame. And it's interesting, with continuous autofocusing and burst mode, there's a lot of different expressions that happen in the span of a second or two. And often, one of them is a lot better than others. Another thing I've noticed is that when people are walking, you know, sometimes the camera catches them sort of an awkward, you know, step, if you know what I mean. And then a half a second later, then they look very natural and their feet are, you know, very well placed. So a lot of those little things pay off when you're using continuous autofocus and burst mode. So I really like it, especially for event work. And I also like it for natural light portraits because, again, people's expressions, they change a lot. They change a lot. And burst mode with a little continuous autofocus works great. Now, we're going to do some fine tuning on that right now because a variation of continuous autofocusing is tracking autofocus, right? And in fact, in the menu, sometimes tracking will be an option underneath continuous. On Canon cameras, they usually call it servo. On the Olympus, they list it as, or at least on my OM-1, they list it as continuous autofocus plus tracking, so it's different than just regular continuous autofocus. But in this case, you know, what you do is you lock in on a subject. You say, I want to follow this, whatever it is, a cat running around. And then the camera will lock in on that cat and will continuously focus on the cat and track the cat across the frame. Again, this works better with some cameras than others. Canons and Nikons are really good at this. I haven't tested it actually on a Sony, so Sony shooters, maybe you can weigh in on that. Olympus was a little behind on that, and they've gotten much better with it, especially with the OM-1. However, I think Canon and Nikon still king of the hill as far as I can tell. It is nice when it works great. And it really depends on how your camera satisfies your needs for the tracking. So it's something that you have to test before you actually need it, if you know what I mean. So go out and, you know, like have your daughter, you know, ride her bike around, use continuous plus tracking, see how it works. If you like, you know, the 100 frames that you capture with it, then you have some trust with it and you can use it in the future. If you have more misses than you're comfortable with, then maybe it's not for you. Again, depends on the camera, but it is an interesting option, especially for cameras that are very, very good at it. Alrighty, so let's move on to a different technology. How about face and eye detection? And this one, I tell you, this one sometimes is really great. And then sometimes when I'm doing event shooting and there's a whole lot of faces changing, right? You know, because let's say there's an event going on, it can actually drive me mad. It just can make me nutty. But essentially, when you turn on face detection, then the camera looks for faces and it puts a little square around them. And, you know, cameras, again, they vary. Sometimes they can be tracking 4, 5, 6 faces at a time. You see like 4, 5, 6 little squares bouncing around in your viewfinder. And then you can fine tune it even more where you have eye detection, right? Because sometimes it's not good enough just to get the face. You need to get the eye. You want the eye really sharp. You want that focus on the eye. You don't want to get faked out by the nose, especially if you have a wide aperture or something. So then they have eye focus. And then, and even the OM-1 has this, you have left eye focus and right eye focus. And this would be more for a portrait. If the face is turned so that the right eye is closest to the camera, then you would use right eye focus. And not let the camera get faked out by focusing on the eye that's further back, if you have just regular eye focus, right? That left eye in the back, which means the right eye would be a little soft. Oh, and we can't have that. That will just make you nutty. Left eye and right eye autofocus as well. Now, these technologies actually work pretty well, especially where you only have, you know, one or two people in the scene. And the thing that it really prevents is that, you know, autofocus systems generally really are like a moth to a light when it comes to lines, right? They love, autofocus loves lines. And most faces are not, you know, have a lot of lines on them. So the reason why I bring this up is that if you're using regular autofocus and there's something with lines that's near the face, let's say a sign that's in between the two faces, and the sign is 5 feet behind the people, yeah, autofocus will go to that sign sometimes instead of the faces, and that will just make you crazy. That'll just make you nuts, right? Because the faces will look terrible. They'll be soft, and that sign will be sharp, and you go, I can't use this photo. There are times when face detection, eye detection are really nice because they tell the autofocus system, okay, forget about lines, okay, for now. We'll get back to lines later. Right now, I really want you to focus on faces, and I don't want you focusing on that poster in the background. And I think that's where face detection works really well. It works great. And again, some cameras better than others. Look around for some options here because you can play around with some models where it just does regular continuous autofocusing and you're pressing the shutter halfway to enable that. And then you could set up the back AF button to enable a face detection, or you could set up a function button that's easily accessible with, you know, your fingers to enable face detection. And it's a toggle on and off. Now, the reason why I bring this up is that you probably don't want face detection or eye detection on all the time, right? No, because we're not always shooting faces. And cameras do have a way of finding faces in rocks and sand and things like that. Probably don't want it all the time, but then when you want it, you want it, and you don't want to fiddle around with the menu system. So if you can set it up with the AF button or with a function button so that when you want it, you just press that button, you turn it on, it's toggled on, You do face, click, click, click. Okay, and then you're back to shooting something else. An establishing shot, press that button again, turn it off, and you're back to your regular autofocusing. I think that is really the nice way to go. Some folks like to use the function button if they have a function button on the side of their lens to enable face detection. I think that's a pretty good one. The AF button on the back, of course, is a good one. So it's something to play around with, but there are times when I truly believe it can save your bacon, right? And in those times, it's nice to be able to access it early and not bury it in the menu system. Because if you have to go digging through the menu system for it, you're probably not going to use it, and you're probably just going to, you know, cowboy up and just use your whatever autofocusing you have set. Get it customized, get it so it's accessible, practice with it a bit to see how your particular camera uses it, and then use it sometimes. And there'll be days where you go, I love this technology. Seriously, there are days where it's really, really nice. All right, now, super fun stuff, right? So human beings are one thing, but subjects are another. Now we're getting into some serious computational photography with subject detection. Yes, and we're seeing this more and more. Definitely have it on the Olympus camera, but it's on other cameras as well. I think the latest Fujis, Sonys, all that are have varying degrees of subject detection. It is actually looking for a particular subject, your camera is. The best one, or the most handy one, I think, are birds, right? Bird detection, because, you know, birds kind of come out of nowhere, and if the camera is really good at bird detection, you can actually get a shot that you would miss otherwise, or you would miss focus otherwise. It will lock in right on that bird, and you'll get that shot. And that's a good feeling. And if you're in continuous burst mode, right, then you go boom, 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 and you get a bunch of shots all in focus. The ones that I have on the OM-1, the subject detections, I can do cars and motorcycles, airplanes and helicopters, trains and locomotives, birds, and then mammals such as dogs and cats. And they work remarkably well. Cars and motorcycles can be nice for certain situations. I know a lot of people have tested out the airplanes and helicopters subject detection at air shows and had really good luck with them. Again, suddenly, you're photographing one thing and then something's happening, right to your right or right to your left, and you whip around. And if you have subject detection, then you can get a series of shots that are in focus. Whereas if you didn't have subject detection, you might just get one or two shots by the time you get everything lined up in focus. So I think this is a really nice addition because you're combining it often with a high-quality telephoto lens. You have subject detection. You shoot in burst mode. Ooh, yeah. It's a good feeling to come home with 5,000 airplane shots, right? But they're all in focus. Okay. And then, of course, there's a manual focus, good old manual focus. And sometimes it's just fun to do manual focus, even with our autofocus lenses. Now, some autofocus lenses are better than others for manual focusing in terms of ease of use. And I really like the lenses I have that have snap focus that allow me just to pull that focusing ring back. I'm in manual focus mode. I just go to what I want. Instead of having to change, find the right autofocus mode. Go, you know what? I can manual focus this in a second, or I could take, 15 seconds to set up the camera for the right AF mode. Sometimes you just go to manual focus, snap focusing ring, pull it back, do your focusing, bang, 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 take your shot, push it forward, go back to autofocus. It can be a beautiful thing. And then as I've talked about recently, putting vintage lenses on your camera also puts you automatically in manual focus mode. And one thing that folks said, and we were playing around with this in our black and white workshop using vintage lenses for our black and white work, is that it slows you down. Manual focus will slow you down, whether you're using your everyday lens or you're putting an older lens on there. You know, you go to manual focus mode, it makes you kind of compose a little better, take a little more time. So if you feel like you're kind of just, you know, bang, bang, bang too much, you want to slow down and get better compositions, go to manual focus mode. Take it off AF, go to manual focus, take a deep breath, and, you know, make some artwork, okay? So it really does have its place in this lineup. Now, in addition to these focusing modes, another area where I feel like I've evolved is trusting the number of focusing points that are active in my viewfinder. I used to only go with a single focusing point, and I would put that point exactly where I wanted it, on the eye, on the subject, wherever on the subject that I wanted to focus, and take the shot, because in the past, like some of these other autofocusing techniques, I had been burned by having multiple points available. The camera just, for some reason, decided that the table in front of the subject was far more interesting than the subject itself, focused on the table, had a very sharp table in the foreground, and then a soft subject. I was photographing the person, not the table, but the camera was photographing the table, not the person. So, you know, that kind of soured me on multiple focusing points. But again, they have become better. And one of the things that I like about multiple focusing points now with almost all the modern cameras is that you have different patterns that you can use. So you don't have to use the whole grid, right? You don't have to use every active autofocus point that's available. You can say, I just want to do a cross, you know, maybe 9 up and down and 9 sideways, you know, or a little square that you move around, or a medium-sized square. You have all these options for focusing point clusters. And then if your camera has a jog stick on the back, then you can use that jog stick to move that cluster around the frame. And I know this happens a lot when I'm doing event work. I'll have a person, let's say, in the lower left of the frame, looking up, talking to someone on the right side of the frame, and I want one of those two people more in focus. I mean, they are the important part of the composition. So I'll move my I use cross more these days, a little cross pattern. I use a jog stick, move it down to that person I want in absolute focus, fire away. And then usually if you double press on the jog stick, when you're done with that, it will move that cluster back to the center of the frame, kind of your default position. Once you get the hang of this, it's really nice. And the reason why I'm going more with clusters, small clusters, for my focusing points is that if the person moves or the subject moves just a little bit at the point of exposure, that cluster will protect you, because maybe originally it's going to be on the center point of the cluster, and now the point that's a little bit to the right because they move that way, the camera will catch it. The camera will catch it. It'll detect that movement, activate that point, focus there, all in a, you know, just a snap of a finger. So I have found that moving small clusters around seems to work really well. It's fun, huh? When we start talking about this, I mean, here we're not even looking at the menu, then all of a sudden we're going, wow, all these neat things my camera can do. I would say my bottom line here, my final thought, is that I'm trusting my camera's focusing decisions much more than I used to. I'm still a little hesitant with face detection in crowded conditions, still kind of warming up to that, but I do use continuous a lot more, cross-sensor a lot more, and subject detection regularly. And my results have been very good. If you haven't played around in your AF menu for a while, go in there, nose around, try some different settings, and then remember, if you have a combination you just want to experiment with, set it up as a custom menu. Set it up as C1 or C2 or C3. So when you want to play with it, you go to C1 or C2 or C3. And then when you're done playing, you want to go back to the way you are more comfortable shooting, then just go back to regular program mode or aperture priority. Alrighty, give it a try. See what your camera can do for you. Fujifilm confirms X Summit event in New York City on September 8th. And you can read the entire article on DP Review. I have a link to it in the show notes. Fujifilm has confirmed that its next X Summit event will take place in New York City on September 8th. Fujifilm hasn't shared any details about what we all can expect from the event, but we do know we'll be getting our first glimpse of Fujifilm's X-H2 camera. After announcing the new X-H2S mirrorless camera at its X Summit back in May 2022, Fujifilm teased the X-Trans sensor CMOS 5HR, a 40-megapixel CMOS sensor. That's right, 40-megapixel CMOS sensor. It said would be used inside the company's forthcoming X-H2 camera system. It's unclear if any further announcements will be made beyond this, but considering Fujifilm's current lens roadmap shows new XF 56mm f1.2 and XF 30mm f2.8 macro lens still due for 2022 launches, it's likely we'll see some additional details about these optics. For anyone based in or near New York, Fujifilm is also holding one of its Fujikina events in the city on September 10th. This will include demonstrations and talks by a series of photographers and filmmakers, as well as a chance to get your hands on some of the company's latest gear. This is the first time Fujifilm has held such an event outside of Japan. Not using auto ISO? You're missing out. You can read the entire article on F-stoppers. I have a link in the show notes. Auto ISO is one of those features that I ignored for a long time, considering it not much more than a gimmick. It wasn't until recently that I decided to try auto ISO, and I quickly realized that I was missing out on a valuable and practical feature. Okay, side note here. So sort of, you know, in the same spirit as revisiting our AF menu, I thought it'd be interesting to run this article as well, talking about auto ISO, because if you haven't used it in a while, there are all sorts of different customizations you can do to it. All right, back to the article. I'll read on. As the name suggests, in auto ISO mode, the camera will pick the correct ISO value for the scene being metered. Initially, the idea of letting my camera pick the ISO value seemed not only silly to me, but also like a genuinely bad idea. I was also firmly entrenched in a film shooter's mentality since I grew up in an era of using ISO 800 film, was pushing the boundaries of grain, and typically only used as a last resort. Obviously, the world changed long time ago, but as many of us know, old habits die hard, especially for us photographers. The beauty of using auto ISO is in the customization that's possible. The camera doesn't simply pick any old appropriate ISO for your exposure, but it gives you a number of other options to ensure you don't wind up with extremely grainy or blurry pictures. In this article and video, so there's an accompanying video that goes with this, I explain how these features work using a Canon EOS camera. But the basics will work with any camera that has auto ISO, which, by the way, is practically every camera, although customization levels will vary by brand. By far, the most common way I use auto ISO is when shooting aperture priority. In this mode, the camera picks the shutter speed and ISO, and I just dial in the aperture that I want. This is a good way to use it. Yep. As a portrait photographer, selecting wide aperture is almost always my main concern, and with two small children, I find this to be one of my favorite ways to shoot. I love not having to worry about the camera picking a shutter speed that is too slow for fast-moving kids, or an ISO setting that's so high my images are too grainy. By dialing in my auto ISO settings, I'm able to retain creative control in situations where I don't have a ton of time to fiddle with settings. In other words, any situation where kids are involved, animals too, right? I found myself using auto ISO with aperture priority more and more when I leave my studio to work in natural light rather than taking some snaps of the kids or a concert in a dimly lit venue. So auto ISO, and there is all sorts of stuff that you can do with it now. If you haven't, I'm speaking now, not the article. If you haven't wandered into your menus for a bit to take a look at what your options are for auto ISO, do it because it's really neat. And you can have a lot of times a couple different auto ISO settings and then, you know, switch between them. you know, making it very easy. And I agree with the author that auto ISO and aperture priority are a great tandem. They work really well together. Boy, this is going to be a fun week for sitting on the couch playing with your camera, right? So you start out, you know, setting up your AF modes and then go over and revisit your auto ISO modes. And then, as I said before, get a combination that you think has promise, set it up as a custom function, and then that way you can quickly test out this combination, and then you can just as quickly go back to your normal shooting modes afterwards. You know, have some fun. Push your camera a little bit. There's all sorts of stuff inside that little brain of its. Take advantage of it. So do a little AF and a little auto ISO. Go find something fun to take pictures of. All right, let's do a little virtual camera club news. First thing I want to do is thank our Inner Circle members. I am having such a blast with them, especially on the group that we have on Derek's Story Online, just for our Inner Circle members. We're running a photo challenge again this month, and it's a good one. It's called, you know, it's a minimalist photo challenge, which is a technique that I really like, you know, where you do these very simple compositions and see what you can do. Then I just wait for the pictures to roll in from our Inner Circle folks who are very good photographers. It's a lot of fun. You know, it's a lot of fun to see other people's comments on the photos. It's just this community that I respect and like a lot. And then they also help support this podcast and this community. And honestly, as I've said many times, you know, they are serving you as well, because of them, I don't have to run weird ads and do promos on this podcast that you probably just don't want to hear. Notice how much content is on this podcast compared to other podcasts you listen to. Notice how few ads. Notice that we don't start out the podcast with a big long ad. We don't have a big long ad in the middle of the podcast. No, you get content. You tune in, you get content. That's because of the Inner Circle support that we have. Tip your hat to them, and even better, join the Inner Circle, become part of this. All you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. Those around there, sign up. You'll also be admitted to the other group where you can hang out, share pictures, comment on things, ask for help, ask for ideas, all that sort of stuff. Big thanks to our Inner Circle members. I truly appreciate you. And finally, a huge shout out to our friends at Red River Paper. These are the folks that have everything that you need for inkjet printing. Everything but the printer. You need to get that. But they'll help you decide maybe which printer to get, right? Do you want a Canon? Do you want an Epson? Take a look at the printer reviews. Do you need a 13-inch? Can you get by with a smaller one? Take a look. See what's going on. Take a look at all the different paper options you have. Get some ink. Think about what kind of creative printing projects you want to do. Do you want to do fine art cards? Do you want to do calendars? Do you want to do framed prints? Red River Paper can help you with all of these things. Red River Paper also has tutorials on how to do creative projects. And then if you're wondering what kind of paper for what kind of subject, guess what? They can help you with that too, from landscapes to portraits to black and white. You name it. It is a fountain of information, and it's all right there. All you have to do is click on the tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. Go over there, start at our landing page, and then nose around from there. And then also remember, they have a wonderful Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. And a huge shout out to them for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, pull out your camera. Take a look at those menus. Try some new things. Take some pictures. And then come back. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.